With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Yeah, you do need a sense of humour. You find that people with a good sense of humour get on and you're happy to work with them. And people who are miserable, you are happy to never see them again.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport and entertainment, who are going to share their wisdom and their use of humour. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve your business success and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast has had the most extraordinarily successful career in the music business. For over 40 years, he's played with a who's who of legendary rock superstars from bands such as Queen, Free, Spandau Ballet, Whitesnake, Duran Duran, the Boomtown Rats, and Roxy Music, to name but a few. He has performed on stage at many of the most iconic concerts of the past 40 years, including Live Aid, the Prince's Trust Party in the Park, and Nelson Mandela's Concert for AIDS. He was also musical director for the Freddie Mercury Memorial Concert at Wembley. As the leader of the SAS band, Spike's All Stars, he has regularly wrangled the richest revolving guest list of rock and roll greats onto stages around the world. Spike Edney, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
Very glad to be here. And I like the use of wrangling and revolving in the sentence. That's really good.
We love alliteration here. Spike, it's lovely to have you here. To survive over 40 years in the music business, do you need a great sense of humour?
You better have one, I think, because you better be able to take the rough with the smooth. And there's an awful lot of rough before you get the smooth. I can assure you of that. So, yeah, you do need a sense of humour. You find that people with a good sense of humour get on and you're happy to work with them. And people who are miserable, you are happy to never see them again. So
do you think that, I mean, having been in bands myself, do you think that if it's not there, you can't stay for that long? For instance, you've been with Queen, I think, since, is it 1985 or something
84.
Like that?
August 84, yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, there must be something about adapting and getting rapport and having a sense of humour that makes them want to be around you for that many years.
Well, let's hope so. There are some bands who kind of thrive on tension and discord, and some of those bands actually do last as long as they take long holidays from each other. And I think that that is the key to any successful big band, is absence makes the heart grow fonder as well. So when you're together, you can have energy and fun has got to be a big part of it. Otherwise, life is miserable. I've been in situations on tour where a band is getting near the end of its life, and everybody's just miserable in everybody else's company, and the smallest thing can be irksome. But that's the same in any group of people, where somebody's slightly annoying habit becomes a major problem for another member of the band. So holidays are good, and having funny people around and in the band to ease the tension is definitely good. And not everybody's funny, but as long as you've got one or two, that really helps.
Well, I always remember the John Lennon quote, and I know you're a huge Beatles fan as well. And when he was going through some miserable times in his life in the studio, which just shows his sense of humour, he turned to Paul McCartney and went, "The reason my life is shit is because your tambourine is out of time."
There you go. I'm not going to believe that. And what was the other great thing in the song on Sgt. Pepper, where Paul McCartney's all jolly saying, "It's getting better all the time, it's getting better," and Lennon comes in with, "It can't get no worse." I mean...
And it stayed in the mix.
Yeah.
No, well, it's an interesting thought, though. Would the Beatles have stayed together if they'd have been allowed a break and allowed some space?
Probably. I'd say probably. What do I know? I can imagine that would work. I could also imagine that you would have to keep your wives out of your business, because that's always a tricky thing. When four guys are being creative together and there's a balance going on, or the hierarchy is kind of set, the power hierarchy, and it's obvious what that was with the Beatles, then to bring in another person can either be a positive thing or a negative thing. I do recall that at one point, John Lennon wanted to invite Brian Jones, when he quit the Rolling Stones, or they kicked him out. He wanted to invite him to join the Beatles because he thought he was a real creative and chaotic influence that he wanted to bring into the Beatles to stir it up. Well, that didn't work out, sadly. So Yoko took that role, and it didn't turn out to be the creative, exciting influence that perhaps he was hoping for. So,
well, you talk about a power hierarchy in a band. Is there a humour hierarchy in a band?
Do you know, the only band that I can think of that didn't have any humour hierarchy was Dixie's Midnight Runners. Their humour was very much frowned upon because I think they thought it showed weakness or something. But I'm trying to think. In every band I've been in, or every group of musicians, there are people who are outstandingly funny, and there are people that are less than funny, but of course you can overdo it. You don't want to over egg the pudding, because the person that's funny all the time can get annoying. I once had the pleasure stroke misfortune to stand next to Frank Carson for an hour. That was the longest hour of my life. The first 15 minutes was glorious. The last 45, I wanted to kill him, because he just wouldn't shut up, you know. And of course it was funny, and I hurt my sides laughing, but I didn't want it anymore. I was done. It was like, you know, too much Christmas pudding till you're sick, that kind of thing, you know.
And another thing.
Have you heard this one? And some of the gags were funnier than the ones he'd done on the stage previously in his routine. He was funnier at the bar than he was on stage. And I kept trying to leave. He goes, "No, you haven't heard this one yet," you know. And, oh, God. Thank you.
I actually met him. He was a friend of a friend of mine. Adrian Walsh is a comedian from Northern Ireland, and used to know him very well. And the word relentless comes to mind.
Relentless humour. I mean, you know, death by laughing, certainly. The other situation I can remember where there was virtually no humour whatsoever was the afternoon I spent in Van Morrison's company. And his band, who were on their own, were very funny, but the moment he walked in the room, they weren't funny anymore. So there was definitely a handbrake of humour in that situation.
A handbrake of humour. We'll be using that one, Spike.
credit me.
Oh, you'll get a credit. And I mean, you know, it'll be in big letters as well. It'll be above the title. What makes you laugh, Spike?
People, the things they say. I mean, it's classic stuff. At the moment you try to be funny, it probably doesn't work. But the accidental humour can have you in stitches. When you work with a bunch of people for a long time, you get a telepathy, and sometimes you don't even have to say anything, you just look. Something happens, and you look at each other, and there have been situations where I turn around, and I don't even say anything, I just look, and if you don't blink, they know that they need to pay attention because something is going on nearby or whatever. And I love that telegraphic thing where you can share humour with somebody without having to point it out.
And does that actually happen on stage as well? Because I know that you are, and I know you don't like the term, but you're the musical director for Queen, or essentially. And so when, I know you don't like the term, but so I use it...
We'll go through that. Yeah, use that advisedly. I do something that is quite unique. A musical director tells them what to play. I don't tell them what to play. I remind them what to play.
We're going to the middle eight now.
That kind of thing has happened on many, many occasions. What happens, how many verses before the chorus, you know, and how many choruses? Well, it depends which version we're doing. Are we doing the 1980 version or the 1990 version? You know, we have so many versions of so many songs that... think of me as as a musical stenographer. I'm the one that sort of keeps all the notes and then pulls out the references when we need to make a decision about something. And if I'll explain all that in detail if you want later. But the humour, you always need the humour because sometimes, well, you know, catastrophe is only one fret away, and you better have some humour in your reservoir or in your reserve account to cope with that because you may need it.
Again, this is yours as well, just for the record. Catastrophe is only one fret away.
Yeah.
I just love that. That is brilliant. I was watching a documentary about Queen, and you feature in it. But at one stage, Adam Lambert is saying, "I kept on looking over at Spike when I first started just to know if I was coming in yet."
Well, that's true, and bless him, he was very, very amenable to that, because some people either are not used to being told what to do or don't have the mechanism or the facility to look around and check. You can work with people who go into a blind panic and close in, look inward, instead of saying, "Oh, bugger, I don't know where I am, I need help." Now, that person I've really got a lot of time for, because that means they're part of the team and I'm always ready to help. Now, Queen hates rehearse. The established members of Queen hate to rehearse. And so bang it through twice and it's in. You know, that's the rule. And then Adam will be leaning heavily on me when that happens.
Well, that's brilliant. I mean, it's funny because I think that stars have always couldn't remember their lyrics. I once, he was in the last days of his career, went to Caesar's Palace to see Frank Sinatra, and it was his wife's birthday, and Nancy opened for him, and was right down the front in the big room at Caesar's Palace. And what I couldn't get over was Frank was reading the words to My Way. And I suppose, you know, well, okay, he was getting older, but I think they just like it as a comfort blanket.
Yeah, sometimes it's only there for if their mind goes blank and they can just look down and remember what the third verse is or something, or do they repeat the first verse? So you can't blame them for that.
Tell me a funny story about when you've been on stage and maybe it's gone wrong, but it's worked out.
Well, this is probably politically incorrect according to modern day sensitivities, but you know, a lot of humour that happens is incorrect. I do and have done for about 10 years now this thing called the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. Now, this is where people who have always wanted to have been in a rock band and played with other people at the highest level can pay money to go away for 4 days to a camp where a person like me brings together the 4 or 5 disparate characters, and basically I whip them into shape so they can go on stage at the House of Blues or the Whiskey A Go-Go and play together as a band, play three songs. Now, this is a terrifying concept to a lot of people. These guys and women may have been enthusiastic musicians in their teens or whatever, gave up when they went to college and became doctors, lawyers, nurses, and now somebody's bought them this as their 50th birthday present. And they come along filled with fear, anticipation. Normally it's a case of, I haven't held a guitar or played a guitar for 30 years. I'm going to make a fool of myself. But it's not what we do is we encourage them and get their strengths and get them to be fulfilled playing with other people. And it works really well. And you can put five people in a room that don't know each other in the morning. By the end of the afternoon, they're arguing about how Wild Thing goes and where does the bee fit in and all this kind of thing. And in 4 days, you've written a song with them and they are on stage at the Whiskey A Go Go or the House of Blues in Hollywood and they are playing together as a band. But it's a really intense but uplifting experience for them. So, and with that in mind, I was brought on board to help organise one of these in London at Abbey Road. And a whole bunch of people from all over the world, we have normally have about 50 or 60 campers, as they call them, they came to Abbey Road and we spend a whole 3 or 4 days playing and we actually recorded a Beatles song each there and we rehearse songs, Beatles songs, and hear stories. But the finale for this one was going to be at the Cavern Club in Liverpool. So we all go up on the train, as in Hard Day's Night, and we all sat around singing guitars, the songs that were in that movie. We tried to recreate that moment for them. So we get to the Cavern, and the idea is that I'm going to be the band leader. And I bring in a couple of the other counsellors. One of them's my good friend, Jamie Moses, who I've played with for 40 years, and he's in my band. And we have this whiteboard at the side of the stage, and there are 35 Beatles songs there. And we are going to play these 35 songs because everybody knows at least one of them. And we set up a chart so that Ted Smith plays drums on Help, and then Pete Jones plays guitar on something else, you know, Dizzy Miss Lizzy. And we didn't really have too much time because we had a limited amount of time, 35 songs, takes a while. And I had this poor stage manager, Tim, whose job it was to line up the guys at the side, a bit behind the stage, to come through the door to be ready for the next song. Now, we have been working for 4 days. None of us had any sleep. We've drunk far too much over those 4 days enjoying ourselves. So you can imagine we were in a bit of a frazzled state. So to start the 35 minutes was okay. But when you're about 15 songs in, you start getting a little bit delirious about what's going to happen, what's happening next. And then when we get up towards the end, up to around about number 30, we're ready to die. I'm ready to die. Jamie's losing his voice. We're absolutely ragged. We're sweating. I feel like it's the end of the world inside. I'm looking at the chart and my eyes are watering when suddenly the organizer runs on stage and says, oh, we've got a special guest. Here's Ted Bloggins, who's going to play drums for you. And I went, who the fuck is that? I have no idea who it is. Oh, he's really famous. He's played with all the big bands up here, all the Liverpool bands. He was in them all, which normally means he wasn't in any of them all. or one of his friends knew the Searchers or something like that. But we didn't care about him. He said, yeah, get him on, you know. So he gets behind the drum kit. And we said, what do you know of this list? And he looked at it and he went, well, not really any of them. I went, what? Well, that shocked me. I said, what do you know any rock and roll? He said, I know Chuck Berry. I said, great. No particular place to go. I said, right, no longer my automobile. All right, so we're off, we go. And we're going around and it goes around a couple of solos. And it gets towards the end. And then the nod and the eyebrow come in. I look at Jamie, his voice is going, say, we've had enough. Look back at the drummer, give him the nod. We're getting ready to stop. And we're all going diddle diddle as though we're stopping. And he's going, good junk. And he's off. He goes again. Bugger. So we go round again, you know. And we come, we get to the end. And there's another nod, a bigger eyebrow to everybody. Here we go. Diddly diddly. Nothing. He's still carrying on. And I thought, this wanker is so starstruck and he loves the limelight, he doesn't want to get off the bloody stage. Yeah. No particular place to go became no particular place to stop. So we go round about four times like this, you know, being, and our gesticulation is getting more and more, bigger and bigger and bigger. And till eventually, on time number five, Jamie Moses turns around and says, "Will you fucking stop playing now?" anyway, oh, bush. And we are shaking our heads. And we said, "What is wrong with you? Are you fucking deaf?" He said, "No, actually, I'm blind." And so all our nods and our gesticulations and all our rock and roll training meant nothing. Well, of course, we cracked up laughing at this. We thought this was absolutely brilliant. Shuggy Sand said, "Well done, mate." And then because the music had stopped for so long, Tim, the tour manager, the stage manager, who was also deranged, ran on. He said, What's happening? Who's this bloke? I don't even know. Who is he? I said, "This is the blind drummer. We're finished with him. Now get me the one-armed trombonist." He said, "Right, I'll be right back."
Well, I think the learning from that story could be summed up by, you know, the film Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels?
Yeah.
And they says, assumption is the mother of all fuck-ups.
Yeah, really, really, yeah.
He must see this, you know, bigger nod.
Yeah.
That is a great story. And, oh, fantastic. I love that. I absolutely love that. So you touched on it earlier on. Is everyone funny or are only some people touched? Because I know that all my musician friends want to be comedians, all my comedian friends want to be musicians, and there's a lot of crossover in that. Is everybody in the music business funny or not?
Interesting. A vast majority of people do have humour, but it's the stories normally, because you sit down with a bunch of musos and somebody tells the story of when they missed their plane or fell down the stairs, whatever, and four or five other guys go, "Oh, hang on a minute, I've got one of those." And I've always maintained that that if you stick a bunch of musicians together backstage with a bottle of wine, the stories will happen, you know. When you're young and your career is really important and you've got to be seen to be cool, maybe not so much, but as soon as you've been around the block a couple of times and it's not your first rodeo anymore, the musicians will have an easy, happy affinity with other musicians. And you go backstage and meet people for the first time. And I spent my whole life meeting people for the first time, especially when we do the Nelson Mandela stuff, where you have to meet artists, get them comfortable and rehearse them and get them out the door so we can do the same with the next one. I can honestly say a room full of comedians is a very unhappy room.
Well, having spent 10 years of my life at the Comedy Store and backstage, I know that everybody goes, "It must have been hilarious." And you go, "Well, no, there were hilarious bits on the stage."
Yeah.
But, you know, most of people are going, you know, running around going, "Keep it tight, because they're really angry tonight, you know."
Is he funnier than me? Oh, my God. He's a therapist backstage, I'm sure.
If you think about it, comedy is the hardest thing in the world, because musicians, and I'm a musician and worked in comedy, musicians can go on and just play.
Yeah.
And if they don't get a huge round of applause or cheers at the end, they can walk off. But if a comedian doesn't get a laugh, it is, you know, that's your feedback loop.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, well, actually, and that's why it is such a hard game. And there's a Jerry Seinfeld quote, which is, you know, the comedy is, you know, the most visceral sort of like closest thing to justice. You know, if you're funny, you survive. You don't think, you know, that you're done for.
Yeah, really.
And it is. Yeah. Comedy is justice. But I'm fascinated by the bits, because a lot of our listeners will be, you know, not working in the music business, will be working in offices, will be, you know, leaders and thing. But you are a leader in a band. So therefore, you value humour And I was very interested in what you said about bringing people together and it being a shortcut to being able to go, do we get on? And can we get this done?
Some artists can be very self-aware. They can also be very introspective and nervous when they're having to deal with other musicians out of their comfort zone, let's say. And there are some who thrive on it. There are some who have no problem. Tony Hadley can walk in and go, hello, mate, whatever, whoever it is. Do you know the song? Yeah, all right, let's go for it. And other people go in and go, oh, my God, I'm working with a different drummer and a different keyboard player. I've worked with the same people for 20 years and now strangers are in my song, you know. And you need a bit of humour to help alleviate that. And the other thing is knowing the song. That really helps too.
Well, but that's what your job is, isn't it? I mean, I think it's all leaders' jobs to make everybody feel at ease. And yeah. The quickest way to make people feel at ease in as a psychologist is to actually get on their level of humour.
Yes, really.
And, and I think it's always incumbent on the person who's leading to find the other person's level. What do you think about that?
Well, yes. I mean, in that position, the band leader is trying to find what makes people comfortable. And sometimes it's humour or just sometimes it's not being too forceful, letting them make the suggestions or giving them options, saying, well, we could do it this way or we could do it that way. I noticed that on your recorded version, you do this, but in your live version, you've changed it to that. What are you most happy with? You know, because you'd never make the decision for them. And they normally say, oh, I prefer the studio version. I hate that live version. I say, well, thank God for that. Anything to break down the barriers, but the humour. And then, of course, when we're playing them, if we make a mistake, always laugh. We always laugh and make a gag out of it. Yeah, it's never a negative moment, you know. And I make mistakes all the time. I put my hand up and I say, sorry, I'm the least trained person here. I fucked up royally. Call me Captain Fuck Up, you know, whatever you want. And they're like, oh, yeah. And that takes the sting out of the situation. And in fact, I've done it on stage as well. If we've launched into something badly and we've somebody wasn't watching the count in, or when you're playing a whole 3 hours of songs, it's easy to get the intros mixed up. That can happen. We've had that before. We've been I've called one song and the guitar player started the intro to another. So because he didn't know the songs that well. You need humour for that. And and I've stopped the band regularly. I have no fear in saying, whoa, hey, everybody's come such a long way, we could at least attempt to play the right version of the song.
Or play the same song.
Yeah, really. All the same song. And the band go, cool, yeah, roll your eyes and then we start again. And the audience... without a doubt, have found this hilarious. And now some artists would freak out at that, but fortunately I've always been in a situation where it hasn't happened that it's affected the artist. I normally stop it before the artist starts singing if it's wrong. Yeah, the humour of that saves that from being a terribly embarrassing situation. A very good friend of mine is a man called Alan White, who was the drummer of Yes.
Yeah.
And he was previously the drummer for John Lennon and Yoko Ono in the Plastic Ono band. In fact, he joined John Lennon after he got a phone call from somebody he thought was pretending to be John Lennon and didn't believe it was him. But anyway, I've done a couple of ad hoc gigs with him and a couple of mates in America. Alan lives in Seattle. And we put together a program of songs, a couple of his songs, the Yes songs, and a couple of other great songs. And there's one song, Owner of a Lonely Heart, is a big Yes song, big Yes hit in the 80s. And it was produced by Trevor Horn, and it has samples in it. And Alan, being quite adept, has used this sample, which sounds like the beginning of the Flintstones. Drums, mayhem, and banging and crashing. It's a really angular piece of music that's a sample that happens in the middle of Owner of a Lonely Heart. And great. So we did the song, and it goes off flawlessly. And we're playing along. We do a few other songs. And then we're going to do I Am the Walrus. by the Beatles. And in the middle of that, there's a bit before it goes into Sitting in an English Garden, or just before that, there's a sort of weird, cacophonous, orchestrated bit. And if you heard it, you would recognize it instantly. So in rehearsal, Alan said, we'll do that bit as well, because it's very hard to actually replicate that live. He said, I'll do the thing, you know, it'd be great. Yeah. And we said, yeah, of course it will. And we ran through it once or twice. No worries. We get on the stage and we do Owner of a Lonely Heart, and we get into that bit, and that's good. And then we come along to I Am the Walrus. We get to the middle bit, and he hits the button, and it goes, Owner of a Lonely Heart kicks off. Now, this floors us completely, because we weren't expecting it. And we went, okay, well, look, we have to stop, because this is a great moment, and everybody's come so far. I've come from London and whatever. Alan, should we try that again? He said, we'll try that again. So we play the thing, lead up to it, and we get to it. And of course, boom, the wrong one. And like four times. We did four times. And so apparently every time he turned the control and pressed a button, he didn't save it or something like that. So it just reverted, you know. Now, nobody cares about that out front. They don't know that you're just one digital number away from catastrophe there. You know what I mean? And that's what happened. And that moment has been a moment that we share, Alan and I share, every time we see each other. I look at him and said, fancy ever playing I'm Walrus again? And he just holds his hands and said, for him, that's a moment that keeps him awake at night. And we all have those.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
Well, I think you've perfectly answered one of my questions, which was, you know, is it important to be able to laugh at yourself? And you've just given lots of examples of that. Of course it is, because it humanizes you, not just to the audience, but to your fellow band players, or if you work in business, to your fellow professionals.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also getting back on the horse, isn't it? Because, you know, if you slip or if you come off the rails, it can go one of two ways. You can either go, oh, my God, oh, we're so sorry, oh, this is awful, and you go negative, or you go, oh, what a cock-up. Well, we can do that better, you know, and turn it into a positive thing and move on. And then it becomes a great moment in the show and the moment that people remember and take away, you know?
Well, did you know that in comedy, they used to, when they did sitcoms, because I grew up going to sitcom recordings because my best friend's dad was William G. Stewart, who used to do Bless This House, Father, Dear Father, and all those big, and Frost and all those. And they used to deliberately build in things going wrong for the live studio audience.
Oh.
because psychologically they used to the audience used to love it.
Yeah.
And it would get them more involved. And so what you've just described is that humanizing and people coming up to you and go, I love that bit,
yeah.
You know, when it went to shit, but they loved it because you stayed in character, as it were.
Yeah.
And held it and went, we all screw up in life.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, you reminded me, I've never done it deliberately. It's only always been genuine. That's enough. but I remember seeing something. It's a charity show where Rod Stewart and Ronnie Wood got back together with Kenny Jones to do a kind of semi-faces reunion for a charity event. And they had, I don't think they were actually rehearsed. They might have had a knock through in the afternoon or something. And Rod introduced, said, here's a song, here's a version of a great R&B blues song that we always loved and we always included, and take it away, Ronnie, you know, Ronnie Wood. So Ronnie Wood starts playing this thing's intro. And then within about three or four bars of the intro, Rod says, oh, Ronnie, come on, mate, now come on. I know it's been a long time, but, you know, give us all a break. At least play the right bloody song. And Ronnie looked at him really weird and played exactly the same thing, and the song went on. And afterwards, I went up to Ronnie Wood and I said, what happened there? Because it didn't sound like you actually changed it. He said, I didn't. He was fucking around. He just wanted to have the moment. And Rod Stewart had called foul on the intro just for the moment. And so I get that totally, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's really... What would the world be like without humour?
Well, it'd probably be like North Korea, wouldn't it? I don't know.
That's a good answer, actually. Yeah.
Humour is our release valve, isn't it? I mean, especially during this time, we need to. I was in lockdown in California during the period here, and I would have a regular Zoom with a bunch of friends. The friends that I would have met down the pub or would have been doing a gig with or whatever, we would get together and just catch up. And it was just a non-stop attack of banter and one-liners and mono-entendres and whatever. that was good. But like anything, you don't want it all the time. You don't want the Frank Carson approach where it just never stops. You want it to be a pressure release and a relief as well. Yeah.
Do you find yourself funny?
Oh, I make myself laugh all the time through my own stupidity. Or I can hear my dad or my mum saying, there we are, right little twat you are. You know what I mean? Sort of, my subconscious puts in their line when I find myself doing the thing that they predicted I would do and fucking up with it or whatever. You know, that's just yes, I do. Well, I do find myself funny. I don't think I'm hilarious and funny all the time, but I have my moments. I think I'm very unfunny sometimes as well.
Well, no, but I mean, because I know so many comedians and this whole podcast and the book is going to be about humour and how it can improve people's lives and, you know, dramatically, it's like, do you think you learnt how to be funny, or was the young Spike funny already and just got better at it?
Right. The young Spike was around funny people without realizing how funny they were. My parents had an ongoing sense of humor, and I'm sure lots of parents do with their kids around. You know, they have their own kind of language and their own rapport and their own dynamic. And they made each other laugh a lot. And my mum was constantly haranguing, not in a bad way, in a funny way, my old man, and we would hear this, and so it was part of growing up. My sister and I would pick up on this, but we thought this was just a normal way of living, to hear this going on. And it was only once I got to see other people, the way other people lived and other people's dynamic with their people. Some people have a miserable childhood, and sadly, and some people have disasters befall them, and parents, they lose their parents or the parents split up or whatever. I didn't. I had my parents until I was 60 years old, and I only left home when my mother invited me to. Because being a musician, it was great coming back from a gig, laying in bed all day, getting my washing done, getting a cup of tea brought in, and having my dinner cooked, you know, and then the next day I'd go off and do it all again, you know. And by the age of about 25, she'd had enough of that. And she was saying, I think it's time you found your own place. I was crestfallen by this, you know, being invited to leave. Then I realized more and more what that bubble of humor, that family humor, was. And thankfully, it's ingrained in me. And when my parents passed, and so many of my friends from my sort of teens, 20s and 30s, who are still my friends now, went to great pains to tell me how funny and brilliant they thought my parents were, and how they used to love coming to our house because they knew that mum and dad would be putting on, you know, inadvertently, just in their normal sort of banter to each other and the way they reacted, a really fun time. And they said they loved it. And I couldn't get rid of my friends. My friends would come around and I couldn't get them out. They wouldn't leave. It wasn't about me. It was about folks, you know. So I realized more and more now that I was blessed by having that growing up. And hopefully life hasn't beaten me up so much that I've lost too much of it, you know.
So there's some kind of genetic thing in it as well, which you think, you know, but hearing humor and understanding it are a different thing, you know, because some people really hear it. And you're, you know, I mean, we met many, many years ago, but you won't remember because you were too busy directing people musically, even though you weren't, if you know what I mean. But when, like, rehearsals for the Freddie Mercury and other rehearsals I went to with Queen, you were always funny. And then we happened to meet again at an event earlier this year, and there was an automatic banter. There was an automatic being able to find the funny. And I think certain people can just find the funny in any situation.
Yes, you're right, there is. And sometimes you can be in a very dark thing. I mean, I've been doing some research digging up some memories for my own book, which I hope will be done by the end of this year. And I was talking to some friends and trying to get the details together of a trip we made to entertain the troops in Bosnia just after it had all stopped there. So this would have been 96, 97, whatever. And we arrived and we were all jolly and uplifted. And our first night was staying in a holiday hotel in Split down on the Adriatic. And then the next day we took a bus up into the mountains to where the main British forces were based. And I can honestly say it was like driving into something that was at the Battle of the Somme. It was the whole camp was just a sea of mud because they were high up in it. And it rained an awful lot and everybody was in tents or quickly fashioned, roughly fashioned barracks and so on. So you had mud and brand new untreated wood. And that vision really stuck in my mind. These guys were there trying to help everybody out and they were living in these conditions. And as we went around and did like five or six shows playing to these young guys, basically, most of them would have been in their early 20s who were there trying to keep these two warring factions apart as one thing. And on the second thing, they were clearing the mess up. And some of the things they discovered were indescribable. And I'm not going to describe them now, just to say that no human being should have to walk in and see what they saw and then try to make sense of it. And to do that on a daily basis, the only thing that gets you through is music and humour. I mean, you know, and we sang a song, We've Got to Get Out of This Place, the Animals song, which had been an anthem to the guys in Vietnam. That was their song. And we realized this and we played it. And the sort of energy and a gusto that they would sing along, it poured out of them. So it was the music and the humor that was their salvation while they went through this nightmare, really, mental nightmare, as well as physical discomfort why they were in a place they didn't want to be and weren't meant to be anyway. They're all meant to be, you know, safe and sound at home with their loved ones, protecting this country, not out there trying to sort out some terrible, terrible conflict. So that really came home to me. And we witnessed this. We witnessed some things, and we witnessed the men and the boys, how they reacted to it. And it was dark humour all the way. You had to have dark humour, gallows humour, whatever you call it, to turn around something that was almost... you didn't want to look at, you didn't want to watch. You needed something to release that. And dark humour quickly turns to light humour. So, you know, that's your way
and
out.
And humour is there to change the state of the people around you. And it changes the dynamic. And so whether it's gallows humour, dark humour, whatever, it's humour. It's humour born out of the situation.
I mean, and some things are dark, but they're not dark at all. I mean, what's the Spike Milligan's gravestone? You know, what's written on his gravestone? I told you I was ill. I mean, that's perfect, isn't it? You know? Jeez. The other thing that really occurs to me is my wife's American. Of course, we're in America and we get to see stuff and we go to see stuff. And I watch things with Americans and they laugh at different bits. I will burst out laughing and they will laugh at something and they won't get what that is just all done. Hadn't seen the humor, the irony or whatever it is I'm singing. And they will laugh at something that's 5 seconds later. And I found that very... My wife at first found that very strange, that I would suddenly guffaw very loudly at something that would tumbleweed around the rest of the auditorium. It's me breaking up.
Wait, talking about national traits, is there a trait for humour in the music business? Because every comedian and every musician, if you want a shortcut to humour, you just say something from the film Spinal Tap.
That is the Bible, the humour Bible, and or Mighty Wind, or any of those. But humour is a national thing. I mean, I've been in setups with American musicians or something, and we laugh at different things. They always think that they're very cool because they like Monty Python. You know, they love that, and Benny Hill, but they don't. You know, they often get the wrong bit of it. they get lots of it. They get the wrong bit of it. But you'll find Americans will wear their Anglophilia or whatever it is. How much they love the Brits by showing how they engage with Monty Python and try and show off their knowledge of what's going on. And it's invariably slightly wrong.
That's just what you want, isn't it? Repeating all the cheeses.
Yes.
Yeah, I know all the cheeses from the sketch. Do you want to hear them? You know, yeah, that's not really the point.
Yeah. Not funny on their own.
Exactly. Going the other way, have you ever gotten yourself out of big trouble by using humour?
At school, I avoided... avoided some confrontations. I was a new boy at a grammar school, having moved, and found myself at the butt of new boy antics. And I used a combination of humour and violence to get out of that.
Oh, that old combination.
That old combo. So I started with violence and then turned it to humour so that everything's fine. And then
more popular I get.
Well, no. Sorry, sir, he's fallen over. Punch, punch, punch. I'm helping you up. Punch, punch, punch. This made everybody laugh in the class and then I became their mate and they hated him, you know. And then we became firm friends because I didn't rat him out.
In business, is it... survival of the fittest or survival of the funniest?
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, look at the President of the United States.
He looks fit to me, Spike.
Fit and funny. He's got it all going on. He's got it all going on there. I think that's too wide a question. There are some people, I'm sure, that have... done very well with very little humour. I think in business, focus and energy form a great part of what you do, but humor will make it all go better. It's like a spoonful of sugar, isn't it, really? If you can be focused and energetic and you can have some humor in, then you've got a full deck. You're playing with a full deck, I think.
You've worked with some of the most unbelievably charismatic people in the world. I'm thinking of Freddie Mercury. I'm thinking of all the lead singers in bands, or maybe, you know, different band members. Was it an essential trait to be charismatic to have humour?
Yeah, I mean, Freddie, as an example, had wicked humour. And had lots of moments where his wicked side would come out, even on stage, even with himself. You know, you see him running around and playing with the audience, and he'll say the most outrageous things. Being on stage would unleash his performing side, which brought out his wicked side, humorous side, even more. Like he used to say, I've got to behave myself tonight because my mother's in. And they walk on stage and he said, "How are you, my fucking beauties?" And it's the first thing he would say on stage. He'd stop himself, you know. And I'd look at him and I think, okay, well, fair enough. You know, he's just been banging on in the dressing room about how he's going to look up, you know, control himself. So, he would have fun. Or something would happen, or he would play something. And sometimes it would just be something. He would play something, he'd cock it up. And he was meandering and he'd mess around. And then he'd look at me and he'd just sort of like smile. And pull a face, which was purely for my benefit because he knew that I knew. And I think that's part of the performance. If you are having fun as a performer, that certainly comes across to the audience, and they pick up on that. And they loved him. And the more outrageous he was, I mean, when he did his AO thing, there's a couple of versions where you see, hey, 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 and he finishes. They look at the audience and go, "Fuck you," to the audience. And that means for being so good, you know, you can fuck off because you can sing it as well as I can, kind of thing. Yeah. They would laugh it up. They thought that was hilarious, you know. And you'd have to be a very sort of straight-laced person not to see the humour in that, you know.
But I think that there is a real credible link between charisma and humour. I think it's very difficult to be very charismatic without understanding the things that actually bond people, that come from humour.
Well, the rhythm, the timing, you know, there's a lot of that going on. And understanding the appropriate, hopefully, getting away with delivering the right thing that will alleviate the situation, or sometimes knowing when to deliver the wrong thing which alleviates the situation, and taking a chance and getting away with it, kind of thing.
Well, what you just described with Freddie, I think, is that cheekiness, which is adorable and just elevates people in other people's eyes. He's saying the things I wish I could, which I think is brilliant.
And maybe explains his appeal, because everybody from all kinds of age groups and demographics and locations, geography, loved Freddie Mercury, from blue rinse grannies who absolutely adored him and still do. Women loved him and men loved him, even though he was gay. They overlooked that, even though some men would have a problem with liking a gay performer. Used to, maybe not so much now, but back in the 70s and 80s, being a gay performer was seen to be a problem. But you get, you know, butch guys having a drink down the pub, like Queen.
Right, we're coming to the end part of the show, which I call quickfire questions. Oh. And I always say it as if we've got a jingle, but we've never had a fucking jingle. So so if you
could... Quickfire questions. I'll do it for you. Quickfire questions. Now, I'm giving you that for nothing, because I'm the man who wrote Edwin Starr's Happy Radio, and I wrote that jingle for him. And I said, if I give you a jingle at the beginning of the track, DJs will use it, and they did. It was a perfect marketing tool to do that. So you should do the same. But get some of your mates together to do a four part harmony and sing quickfire questions.
Well, I'm hoping you're now my mate, and you'll go away and do it, Spike.
No, sorry, I'm far too busy. you can sample the original one I just gave you. Quickfire questions. Okay, so you can double that up and then add harmonies to it. Okay,
that's the one. Okay. we're going to be taking that into the studio. There's going to be four, and PRS will be calling you forthwith.
That's my retirement program there, right? And that's my thing.
It really is.
And what you should do, of course, is get everybody from now on to do that. So you count them in 3, 2, 1, and they do it. And then you can put them together as a postage stamp thing.
Oh. All right. We're going to quick fire questions. Who's the funniest person you've met in business?
Who do I always have? Do you know what? I can't tell you that there's one. There's a whole rake of people I'll tell you who's really funny to be with. And from the moment you sit down, and you very rarely get a serious word in, and that's Jeff Beck.
Really?
Hysterical man, with a great mind for humour and a great reservoir of human knowledge. I was at something with him the other day, and we started talking about people that he would really admire as guitarists. And I said, well, who's it go back with? And Link Cray was a really early, heavy sort of like guitar player. But then the joke was going to be that Jeff Beck knew John McLaughlin. That was it. And that John McLaughlin had put out an album, apparently, and I haven't seen this, I don't know, but on the front of it is like a little business card that apparently he had printed John McLaughlin when he was a youngster. So I mean, he said, Johnny McLaughlin plays guitar, available for weddings, funerals, I mean, something like that. It's a really shitty business card from the 60s. Anyway, he took this business card and put it on the front of an album. Now, I haven't seen that, so that may need some fact check on that. And we said, oh, God, yeah, John McLaughlin. And we said, well, how amazing was it when the Mahavishnu Orchestra just descended? I think it was the early 70s, I think. Now, for musicians, the early 70s was an incredible time of boundaries being pushed, envelopes. And the Mahavishnu Orchestra, with the interplay of John McLaughlin's incredibly free-form, energetic and inventive guitar, along with the first violinist and the drumming. And Roger said, oh, of course, and wasn't that drummer fantastic? And I said, oh, you mean Billy Cotton? And of course, it isn't Billy Cotton, it's Billy Cobham. Mm-hmm. But Billy Cotton used to have a radio show, Wakey, Wakey, the Billy Cotton Band Show. Jeff Beck fell over laughing because he got the reference immediately, the fact of having Bill Cotton, who was a baldy old conductor, playing drums with the Mahavishnu Orchestra. He made the contact immediately. Now, I can't tell that joke to very many people. I can't tell that story because it will whoosh straight over the head. You need to have all the references from the John McLaughlin with the Mahavishnu to the Billy Cotton Band Show. And you only know about the Billy Cotton Band Show if you were a kid in the 50s. So there you go.
No, they're brilliant. By the way, you've killed quickfire questions.
Oh, my boy. Probably for the best.
What book makes you laugh?
I used to read as a schoolboy Jennings and Derbyshire, The Adventures of Jennings and Derbyshire, and I was writing about that as a piece, trying to recall school days, and I bought one online, and at the age of 68 it still made me laugh. Something that's designed for a 12-year-old, so which really shows the talent of the author,
you know?
I won't read all of them, but I read that. Yeah. And also what's making me laugh at the moment is the story of Jimmy Webb.
Oh, well, I'll take that as a recommendation because I just think he was a genius.
Yeah, and it's not a funny book as such, but some of the things that happen in it, I personally really related to and just echoed things.
What film makes you laugh?
Oh, always makes me laugh. It's a mad, 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 mad world, which features a Spencer Tracy in a straight role. But and it's really strange. I always like that film because there's one gag in there where Jimmy Durante is laying on the side of a rocky mountain and he croaks. As he croaks, his foot shoots out and it kicks a bucket down the hill. And I saw that in a cinema and I cracked. And it makes me crack now just because of the timing. It was so unexpected. And as it turns out, you know, the way things go around, that film was shot and is centred upon where my house is in Palm Springs, California. So I feel that it's a film about the home I have now, just ahead of time.
What word makes you laugh?
Well, bollocks is always a good one because it's so useful. Yeah, I'm making you laugh too.
It does. Well, my favourite thing of that, do you remember when Virgin was sued for the cover of Nevermind the Bollocks?
I do indeed, yeah.
And John Lydon, who I'm sure you've met as well, who is a funny man, and he was interviewed by like Thames News at 6 or something, and then outside the court, and they went, put a mic in front of his face and went, John Lydon, what do you think of the verdict? And he went, bollocks is legal. Bollocks, bollocks, bollocks. On a slightly serious note, in quickfire questions, we'd always like to stick one in. What's not funny?
Racism. Unfortunately, in music, it's one of the least, as far as I'm concerned, least racist things you do, because we meet and work with people from all over the world, from all kinds of musical cultures, and I embrace that. So... I'm glad to say that. Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for everybody in all situations, and there will be people who will say, no, hang on a minute. That's the one thing I would say is adults.
But music changed the course of a lot of things with racism. Yeah. Even if you go back to the Beatles and the Stones, they were listening to all the black artists and were actually the people that brought those black artists back to America, really, and gave them an audience.
Very true, very true. Yeah, I mean, people like Chuck Berry and Little Richard, very grateful to the Beatles and the Stones for opening up audiences to them in America. Mm-hmm. And radio stations, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
Playing back music. I mean, it's unbelievable to think that now, you know, it's quite a very hard.
Yeah, extraordinary. Would you rather be considered clever or funny?
Oh, God. Can I be both?
No, these are the rules, Spike.
Do you know what? There are different hats for different days. There are days when you certainly want to be considered clever, but most of the time it'd be nice to be considered funny. Yeah.
No, that's a good answer. And finally, desert island gags. You've got one gag that you can take with you to a desert island. What's that gag?
You know, I don't think it's necessarily a funny gag, but it brings a smile to me because the way I heard it, and it was told to me by, not told to me, I heard it from a comedian that I wasn't particularly a fan of because my dad didn't like him. And that was Bob Monkhouse. Bob Monkhouse was on TV a lot, and he was on TV in the 50s, and my dad used to go, that smarmy git, why is he on again? You know, it was really, and I said, yeah, of course, he's smarmy git. You know, so I had that inbuilt prejudice. And then I heard him say this one thing, and I think I used it in a moment, I'm not sure, and it was with the members of Queen, so I was the first one to pass this gag on to them. And said, and from Bob Monkhouse, he said, when I was young, people asked me what I wanted to do or what I want to be when I grew up, and I told them I wanted to be a comedian, and they all laughed. They're not laughing now.
Brilliant. We love Bob. Thank you so much, Spike. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'd like to stay and talk to you, but I've got to go and wait in the lobby for the limo.
Yeah, so... Superdrone.
Spike Edney, thank you so much for being my guest on the Humorology podcast.
Hey, it was fun. I had a laugh.
The Humorology podcast was hosted by Paul Barros and produced by Simon Banks. Music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.